The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them, because by this time tomorrow I will hand them all over to Israel, slain. You are to hamstring their horses and burn their chariots." So Joshua and his whole army came against them suddenly on the waters of Merom and attacked them. And the Lord gave them into the hand of Israel. They defeated them and pursued them all the way to Great Sidon, to Misrepoth-Maim, and the valley of Mizpah on the east, until no survivors were remaining. Joshua did to them as the Lord had directed. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots. And at that time Joshua turned back and captured Hazor and put its king to the sword. Everyone in it they put to the sword. Hazor was totally destroyed, them not sparing anything that breathed, and he burned up Hazor itself. Joshua took all these royal cities and their kings and put them to the sword. He totally destroyed them, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. Yet Israel did not burn any of the cities built on their mounds, except Hazor, which Joshua burned. The Israelites carried off for themselves all the plunder and livestock of these cities, but all the people, they put to the sword until they were completely destroyed, not sparing anyone that breathed. As the Lord commanded his servant Moses, so Moses commanded Joshua, and Joshua did it. He left nothing undone, all that the Lord had commanded Moses. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, today I would like to talk about something which has come up a lot on this show, and this is the issue of group selection. Now, there are some people who remain, which basically is the essence of genocide, group selection. There are some people who remain sceptical of the concept of group selection. And so what I would like to do in this video is go through all of the arguments against group selection and refute them. Now, what is group selection? Well, remember, we can pass on our genes in a variety of different ways. We can pass them on at the level of individual selection, so we have children and we pass on our genes. We can pass them on at the level of kin selection. This is that you invest your resources in your kin, in your nephews and nieces, for example. These are 25% the same as you, and so by doing that, you are indirectly benefiting your genetic interests. Now, all group selection is doing is extending that idea of kin selection, with kin selection being widely accepted. All group selection is doing is saying that ethnic groups are extended genotypes, and this is a fact. The research by Frank Salter, for example, has demonstrated, using genetic assay data, that so-called ethnic groups cluster together and are extended genotypes. And two average Englishmen have more in common genetically than do an Englishman and a Frenchman. This means that we can understand the ethnic group as an extended kinship group. And so if we can pass on our genes indirectly via kin selection, it must follow that we can pass on our genes indirectly via what's called group selection. We're talking about multi-level selection here, different levels of selection, because there's no essentialist border between kinship and ethnic group. They're simply a graded extension of the same thing. And it would further follow that we could go further than ethnic groups and we could pass on our genes via a higher level of group, a more extended level of group, such as race. And it's been demonstrated that there are races clearly genetically clustered together, and there are about 12 separate races, according to Frank Salter's data. And you could even take it further and look into races that are more or less similar to each other, and even look into species. This is multi-level selection. So this is all it is saying, that the ethnic group is an extension of the kinship group, and you can pass on your genes. You can elevate your genetic interests by investing in a person who is the same ethnic group as you, over a person who is not, just as you can elevate your genetic interests by investing in a person who is the same kinship group as you or your family over a person who is not. And in Frank Salter's book on genetic interests, he actually calculates how many members of a different ethnic group would have to invade a country for it to be the equivalent of each individual in that country losing the equivalent of one child. And the less genetically similar the two ethnic groups are, the fewer people have to invade from the other ethnic group for it to be the equivalent of you losing one child. Now, this, of course, explains why it is that, very neatly, why it is that people are prepared to be self-sacrificial in times of war, which is what I want to focus on in this video. But I want to do a couple of things first. It explains why. Why would people lay down their lives for the group in times of war? Why have we seen again and again and again throughout history? History is dominated by wars, such as that which was explicated in the book of Joshua at the beginning of the programme. Why would people do that? Well, the reason they would do that is because when their group is under threat, when their entire group might be destroyed by another group, then it will make sense. It's in their genetic interests to lay down their lives in times of war. Hamilton's rule, as it's known, would predict that there's going to be variations in whether you're going to do that. I mean, for example, a mother who is menopausal, who can't have any more children, who has one child, and that child might die, is more likely to sacrifice her life, lay down her life for that one child, than she would do if she was very young and could have loads more children. Because it would be in her genetic interest to lay down the life of her own life for her child if she could have no more children, and she only had one child, but it wouldn't be if she could have lots of children. So there's all kinds of variations like that. But anyway, that is genetic. That is the essence of group selection, and that's why group selection works, and that's why group selection makes sense of, from a Darwinian perspective, it makes sense of self-sacrificial behaviour. Now, there is a great deal of empirical evidence that we do behave in a group selected manner, and in a manner where we indirectly pass on our genes. One of these is the research that's been presented by J. Philippe Rushton, so-called genetic similarity theory. He looks at numerous markers of this. So not only do we engage in kin selection, not only do we preferentially assist our kin compared to non-kin, but friendships. People that are friends are not random. They are more genetically similar to each other than two random members of the same ethnic group, i.e. through friendship, we are indirectly helping to pass on our genes. From helping another person who's our friend, we are indirectly passing on our genes. People that get married are more genetically similar than two random members of the same ethnic group. Why? Because if you marry someone that's genetically similar to you, then you're engaging in a sort of extended kin selection, a kind of group selection. You're indirectly passing on more of your genes. Even within families, people tend to be closer emotionally to those that are more than brothers, for example, and sisters. They're not exactly 50% the same. And people tend to be more close to those who are more genetically similar to them. So this again shows you that what we're talking about here is people indirectly passing on your genes. He presents evidence, and lots of evidence, that this operates as well at the group level. So, for example, people are more likely to give money to beggars that are the same ethnic group as them than beggars who are a different ethnic group from them. Why? Because helping the beggar who is the same ethnic group as them is indirectly passing on their genes. Students tend to live with people who are the same ethnic group as them disproportionately. Why? It's indirectly passing on their genes by bonding with people that are the same ethnic group as them. People, even in academia, tend to cite academics, all else being equal, that have a name, a surname, that is of the same ethnic group as theirs. Why? Because by citing the person, they are helping to indirectly pass on their genes, because they're assisting that person's interests. Now, the arguments that have been levelled against group selection are there's a number of kinds. The first of those presented by Steven Pinker, in an essay called "The False Allure of Group Selection." His argument is firstly that group selection deviates from the random mutation model inherent in Darwinian selection. Well, that is no argument, because firstly, so does kin selection, but no one's criticising that. And secondly, of course it does. By its very nature, if it's an extension of Darwinian selection, it's going to deviate slightly from the metaphor. So you're only saying that the Darwinian metaphor is holy and we can't question it. So that's no argument at all. Secondly, he says we won't be selected ever to damage our genetic interests. Well, that completely misunderstands what group selection is. Group selection is saying that you are in, you promote your genetic interests on various levels. You could argue that if you invest energy in your nephews and nieces, you're damaging your own genetic interests because you're not. You could invest that energy in yourself personally. You could argue that if you invest energy in your nephews and nieces, if you have children, you're damaging your children. No, the idea is that you can invest, you can elevate your genetic interest through indirect investment. So we're not being selected to damage our genetic interest at all. We're being selected to elevate our genetic interests. Thirdly, he says, humans do not engage in self-sacrifice like sterile worker bees. Well, that's obviously nonsense. I mean, that just shows that he has no understanding of history whatsoever. History is replete with people who engage in the most incredible acts of self-sacrifice on behalf of people they barely know, on behalf of other soldiers, on behalf of their group. Suicide bombers are examples of people engaging in self-sacrifice on behalf of their group. Loads of cases of men who won the Victoria Cross or the Military Cross in the World Wars, who engaged in incredible acts of gallantry and self-sacrifice to the point of death on behalf of their group. Perhaps someone like Steven Pinker cannot comprehend that people would be so group selected, so group oriented, that they would engage in acts of self-sacrifice for their group. So he kind of dismisses it. But these things clearly happen, and they happen frequently. And suicide bombing is an obvious example of this. Thirdly, he says that. His next argument is basically it's a fallacious argument. So he's saying it's a false allure. That fits in with the whole problem of his argument. It's like he doesn't like it for his own personal reasons. He doesn't like it. The false allure of group selection. Let's look at the language that he uses. The false allure of group selection. It's saying it's like sexual. It's saying that group selection is like some whore, and that people have been manipulated by a sort of a whore because they're stupid. This is a fallacious emotional, manipulative form of argumentation. The fallacy is known as the poisoning of the well. It's manipulating people against the argument using linguistic tricks and whatever. And now, why do people use fallacious arguments? Well, normally because they have some emotional reason for not liking the concept. They can't argue against it logically, so they have some emotional reason for not liking it, and so therefore they use fallacious arguments. And perhaps that's what we're dealing with Steven Pinker, as someone has emotional reasons for not liking group selection. Another argument against it was levelled by Gregory Cockrum. He said that he'd done mathematical calculations indicating that it was most unlikely that group selection could ever develop. But all that can be said to that is that out of the millions and millions of species that exist, you would expect group selection to develop eventually. And it is the thing that makes the most sense of what's happened among humans. And therefore, why shouldn't we accept that group selection has developed if it is the most parsimonious explanation for what is going on among what is, after all, a highly pro-social species? The final argument against it, and it's the one I want to focus on, really, and it brings me back to what I did, to what I was talking about the Book of Joshua at the beginning, is the idea that human populations have traditionally been too sparse for group selection to manifest. Human populations, we are evolved essentially to the savannah. That is really what our evolution is too. We're talking about small scale populations, groups of about 30 people, something like that, that don't have much to do with each other, and consequently group selection could not possibly have developed. Well, there's two counter arguments to that. The first counter argument is simply that evolution clearly sped up once we left the savannah and once we entered what is called the Holocene, i.e. once we developed farming. And once we develop farming, that's when evolution heavily sped up. You have and Cochrane and Harpending, in fact, looked at this in their book, The 10,000 Year Explosion. Evolution accelerates hugely. You have the development of blue eyes, you have the development of blonde hair, you have the development of light skin, you have the development of lactose tolerance, you have the development of alcohol tolerance, whatever, all kinds of things. Evolution, we are not evolved to the savannah. Evolution sped up hugely once we left the Holocene. And so the argument that, well, if something wasn't the case on the savannah, it doesn't make sense on the savannah, it doesn't make sense, is no argument at all. We know, for example, that we were under selection for intelligence, under strong Darwinian selection for intelligence in Western countries till about 1800. And that is something that sped up after we left the savannah. We know that we were under strong selection for religiousness, and that people that are off the savannah are more religious increasingly than those that still live Stone Age hunter-gatherer lifestyles. So we were under selection for religiousness, which is about 0.4 to 0.7 genetic, off the savannah, in the Holocene. So evolution sped up. So on a theoretical level, it is simply no argument to say that because the savannah was like this, therefore there can't be group selection. And anyway, even if you look at the savannah, or there is clear evidence that there most certainly was very intense group selection. And what does group selection involve? Group selection involves fights between groups, fights between separate, distinct ethnic groups who, as we have noted already, are genetic clusters, are separate genetic clusters, evolved slightly different ecologies. According to computer models, Hammond and Axelrod's paper on this, according to computer models, the group that is more likely to win in the battle of group selection is the group that is higher in positive ethnocentrism, that is to say internal cooperation, getting on with each other, cooperating so you can make good weapons and, you know, have a cohesive society and whatever, and negative ethnocentrism, the group that will act with intense violence towards the outside group. Positive and negative ethnocentrism. Another issue that will predict winning in the battle of group selection is also intelligence, because if you are higher intelligence, then you can create better weapons and whatever. Religiousness, by the way, is associated very strongly with ethnocentric attitudes. Why? Well, because we were evolved to be religious on this, under Darwinian conditions, because it reduced stress and made people less stressed, and also made people more pro-social and therefore more ethnocentric. And it goes together with ethnocentric attitudes, which is why religious groups tend to be more ethnocentric, and why when religiousness declines, people become less ethnocentric. But let's actually look at the empirical evidence for this. The empirical evidence, therefore, that there was intense warfare, indeed genocide, with these hunter-gatherer, primitive, pre-agricultural or pastoralist groups. Because if you literally have cases of one group wiping out another group, then you have group selection. Because the group that has wiped out the other group is going to have traits, average traits, which will mean that it's able to defeat the other group. And that means that those average traits, things like ethnocentrism and intelligence, are more likely to be passed on. And therefore, selection must be operating at the group level. And it undermines the argument that, oh, we were living in these small bands and therefore their group selection couldn't possibly operate. Let's look at it. First of all, people that have looked at chimpanzees and done ethnographies of chimpanzees have shown that you literally have group selection among chimpanzees. You have groups of chimpanzees that band together. At times of non-crisis, they seem to live in relatively isolated groups. But at times of crisis, they band together with other similar chimpanzees and they fight against other groups of chimpanzees. And there are cases that have been documented of them literally wiping out other groups of chimpanzees. One group of chimpanzees that, for whatever reason, is more aggressive, more negatively ethnocentric, more well-organized, better able to use basic tools or whatever, literally wiping out another group of chimpanzees. So it seems that even among our most recent ancestors, the chimpanzees, you have group selection. You have the killing of entire groups of strangers by chimpanzees. Secondly, if you look at this time, so we're talking the time where we are hunter gatherers, there is abundant evidence of groups fighting other groups and killing almost all or all of the males in that group. Napoleon Chagnon looks at this when he looks at the Yanomamo, which is a very, very violent hunter-gatherer group in Venezuela. At normal times, they are quite disparate and they are in small, vaguely related bands spread across the forest. But when they come under attack, then these vaguely related bands seem to come together into a bigger band, and then they will go after those that are from a completely different tribe and are very different from them, and will destroy them and take their women, particularly kill all the men and take their women. So we have clear evidence amongst the groups in the Amazonian rainforest of group selection. Yes, it is true that at normal times you have these small bands that don't cooperate to any great extent, about 30.
But there seems to be this rule whereby those bands communicate with each other, those bands have a set of relations with each other, those bands have common ancestors, those clans or whatever, have common ancestors, and they will come together into a group at times of crisis, and they will wipe out another group that is invading their territory. So this group violence is extremely clear. It's a very interesting book on this called Violence and Warfare Among Hunter-Gatherers, in which it shows that this idea of the peaceful savage, which has been promoted by people like Rousseau or whatever, is a complete myth. Archaeological evidence indicates again and again the presence of mass graves, whereby entire, what would be the equivalent then of an entire group, an entire social organisation, is clearly wiped out by another group. As we move into the Holocene, when you have the development of farming, you have much more tightly bound groups. You have groups that don't move around. You have much more intergroup conflict. Group sizes become larger. Levels of war increase. And as you get into pastoralists and farmers, and you have increasing evidence from the archaeological record of people being completely wiped out. But you don't even have whole peoples, but you don't even have to go that far. You can just look at hunter-gatherer groups. In the 1800s, for example, among Eskimos in Alaska, there is evidence of entire social organizations, entire sort of de facto villages being killed, being wiped out by other members of a village. There was in the 1860s, there was a war between the Inupiaq and the Netsalik Eskimos, and all of one of those two groups of Eskimos were killed, ended up being killed, every single one. In 1510, when the Portuguese tried to invade part of southern Africa, a band of 150 men got together to kill them, got together to try to destroy them. So this shows you that the idea that we're in these tiny little groups that are too sparse for group selection to take place is evident and palpable nonsense. In times of crisis, these sparse little groups that are dotted all over the place, who have a vague sense of a common ancestor, a vague sense of being a tribe, these clans, come together into a broader group and act in their interests. So normally there's about 30 people or whatever, no more, but then you've got 150 men who are just hunter-gatherers, who are just hottentot, coordinated together, attacking the Portuguese invaders in 1510. So this shows you that, yes, they are sparsely populated, but in conditions of crisis, these sparsely populated groups come together and fight in their genetic interests. In other words, we have something like group selection. As I said, there was a case among Eskimo villages of what was going on there. We know that they would have, these villages would have stockades. They would have clear territory. They're a burial ground. They would have axes that were clearly used for fighting rather than for killing animals. They would take trophies of the dead, such as body parts and whatever, and display them. What's talked about in this book is a rule of 10 or a factor of 10, whereby it seems that whatever is the number of people in an everyday quotidian social group seems to multiply by about 10 in a time of crisis, i.e. when you're under attack from another group, such that you have much larger groups. So you have two substantial groups fighting each other. In other words, you have group selection. Evidence from the Bushmen indicates that of a population of 400 people, 22 people are killed by murder. So this is a substantial percentage of the population die by murder. What is this murder? Well, it's internal, but it's also at the hands of other groups. And he highlights in the book that we have here basically 2,000 generations, we could argue, 2,000 generations of humanity, where we have been under selection to be warlike, where we have been under selection to be group selected. So it would be extraordinary in that sense if we were not group selected. The number that he then goes through, the Aborigines, for example, there's clear evidence that the Australian Aborigines had evidence of group selection. They had weapons that were used for things other than hunting, therefore they were used for fighting against other people. There was testimonies from various people in the 1800s of entire Aboriginal groups, of entire tribes being wiped out, being killed by other groups. By the Murray Basin, which is a place rich in resources, this is a place that is littered with skeletons that have been killed in an extremely violent way, killed by axes and things like this, Why? Well, because it's a place of rich resources, so different groups are going to fight over it, so you're going to get death at the hands of these different groups, and of course this is going to affect the nature of these groups, who gets killed, who doesn't get killed. It's going to make them more or less ethnocentric, presumably more ethnocentric, and therefore you're going to get an issue of group selection. Also, he notes, if you look at the myths in these groups, the myths all talk about the ancient times, all talk about one group willfully and deliberately destroying another group. So this, in their own sort of record, it's an oral record, of course, but in their own record, you have one group destroying, wiping out another group, i.e. you have genocide. And as I say, the skeletons that you have that are preserved from the Paleolithic and whatever are lots of people that have been killed by lethal trauma, i.e. by warfare. So the idea again that these groups are too sparsely populated to be selected for group selection, too sparsely populated for there to be warfare in the, among hunter-gatherers, is simply untrue. Now, another book which is very, very interesting and worth having a look at is Blood and Soil by a chap called Kiernan. And he looks, it's published by Yale University Press, and he looks again at the evidence that it seems that we may have killed off the Neanderthals. So that would be an example of group selection. But he looks at the archaeological evidence, and it's quite clear that you have competing local communities under hunter-gatherer times who annihilate each other. And if you go into the Holocene, he says in 5,000 years ago in Germany, you have evidence of a mass grave of 34 men, women and children. They have been slaughtered by stone axes and bits of their bodies have been taken off and taken away as trophies. As farming comes in, this whole thing speeds up. In Talheim, 7,000 years ago, you have a mass grave of men that have been butchered and killed with axes and whatever. So again, this shows you there's intense warfare among these hunter-gatherers. 2,000 years ago in Germany, mass grave of 100 people, all of them slaughtered in the most brutal way possible. You see it in the Bible, as I said, in the book of Joshua. The Bible, although some bits of it are exaggerated and whatever, and it can be seen as religious propaganda, the Bible is basically recording, although they see it as the will of God or whatever, and the action of God, is basically recording group selection in process. It's recording a system whereby the Israelites are highly group selected, they are extremely religious, they fear the Lord, they are very, therefore, they are very high in positive ethnocentrism because it's God's will, because, you know, religiousness seems to be associated with ethnocentrism because the two things have been selected for in parallel, and also because the religion that promoted ethnocentrism would be the religion of the group that survived. The groups that had religions that didn't promote ethnocentrism wouldn't have survived. So therefore it makes sense that religion renders the will of God ethnocentric behaviour. And so they are highly ethnocentric, and they go into groups which are less ethnocentric than them, and they wipe them out. And they don't just wipe out a few of them, they don't just kill a few of them, they wipe out everybody. And you see this in the book of Joshua. It's quite, we're talking about city states here, and they go into Jericho, to the Amorites, to whatever, and they kill all the people. God says, thou shalt smite and utterly destroy them, I will wipe them out. And you see this process of God encouraging group selection. And it's not just Christianity either. If you're going to get these people that are going to say, oh, that's the Bible made up. I mean, the Dalai Lama in 1660 instructed his followers, this is the fifth Dalai Lama, to annihilate any trace of them and even to annihilate their name. To wipe off, to get the group that is not your group, that is in competition with you, and to wipe them off the face of the earth. So what we could argue is that we are homo religious, but we are also homo genocidus. We are evolved towards genocide. The group which commits genocide against a competing group, which totally wipes out that group, not just kills a few of them, but totally wipes the group off the face of the earth that is competing with them for resources in history, would have been the group that would have been more likely to survive and therefore more likely to pass on its genes. And that would mean that over time we would be selected towards genocide. We would be selected to be a genocidal peoples that in times of crisis and competition would attempt to wipe out everybody, or at least wipe out most of the men and take the women as trophies. And now that's what you see in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, that's not so overtly demonstrated, but then the New Testament takes on aspects of Old Testament ideas and makes that into Christianity, and you end up with this with these Christians who are this highly group selected group that believe that God is on their side they're slightly more open to outsiders, so they're not an ethno group. This allows them to create a sort of genius strategy because it means they can trade. They're not so ethnocentric, they can trade and whatever, but they have God on their side, and God tells them that you have to be moral, and they become this highly moral pro-social group. They see those that aren't part of their group as not worshipping their God as immoral, and thus it's okay to put them to the sword. And thus the groups that take on Christianity, such as the English or what are the Europeans, expand at the expense of other groups, because they are highly group selected, and they are highly group selected because they believe that being group selected, that being violent to outsiders, but highly positively cooperative, is the will of God. But also, of course, it allows you to pass on more of your genes. And now it seems that the mantle of group selection has passed to the Muslims. The Muslims genuinely believe in God. We've stopped believing in God in the West, and therefore we've stopped being group selected, because it was religiousness which upheld as sacred group selected attitudes. And therefore, it's simply the Muslims that are the most group selected people. Therefore, are doing all of these evolutionarily adaptive things. They are having lots and lots of children. They are basically taking over territories via a sort of invasion from below, with Allah telling them what to do and telling them it's his will for them to expand and for them to act in a group-selected fashion. And so this really is the process of history. But all that can be clear is that the argument against group selection, the only argument that these people have left, is that, oh, well, we're with these two small groups and there's no evidence of group selection among hunter-gatherers, is absolute nonsense. These groups were genocidal. And were able to come together into highly cooperative groups at times of crisis and defend themselves against other groups to the point of wiping those groups off the face of the earth. And the fact that the Old Testament, which is references things that were happening about 1000 BC, shows you this was going on, shows you that this has been selected for over many generations. And so, of course, we have been selected to be group selected, and the ultimate group selected people these days are clearly, I mean, it's quite obvious what is going on. It is those that follow God, with God mandating group selected values as the will of God. It is those that are group selected, and it is those that will triumph in the battle of group selection. Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar! As they say. But no, seriously, clearly, there is no logical argument against group selection whatsoever. And those who don't accept it either are willfully ignoring the overwhelming amount of empirical evidence that under prehistoric conditions, under hunter-gatherer and early farming conditions, there was huge levels of genocide, huge levels of groups killing off other groups. And once you've got that, you've got the groups that survive, and they are going to have traits that are on average going to be different from the traits of those that were killed, and therefore you have selection operating at the group level. And that even puts aside all of the other arguments I've presented. Group selection is very, very real, and it is a huge part of what is happening in our world today. Well, I hope this has been of interest, and if it has, then remember that I live stream on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York. If you want to support the show, you can do so on the channel. You can do so below. You can see the ways to do so through various means, and I'm most grateful. Please subscribe. I'm very, very grateful if you do that, and I will see you soon. And goodbye!